Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem, he's out of control.
Hello and welcome to the 8th episode of Jughead's Basement, featuring Naked Raygun's 1985 release of Throb Throb. This episode will be handled slightly different than usual. While interviewing my friend Dan Vapid during the Screeching Weasel My Brain Hurts episode, we got talking about this basement project and the bands that Vapid would love to hear about. He mentioned Naked Raygun, and we both said in unison, Throb Throb. And so Vapid and I gathered our resources, contacted all the members of Naked Raygun appearing on Throb Throb, and began our interview process together. This is the product of those interviews. So here is a short discussion I had with Vapid after we had completed the interviews. Dan Vapid has been in many bands in his productive career as singer-songwriter. He has been in Screeching Weasel, Sludgeworth, The Queers, The Riverdales, The Methadones, and his latest band, Dan Vapid and the Cheats. So here, to begin this episode, is Vapid and Jughead, literally, in my basement. All right, Dan, so I'll just ask you these questions and you rattle on, or just short answers or whatever you think. What came first, listening to Throb Throb or seeing Naked Raygun live?
I saw Naked Raygun live with the Dead Kennedys.
Oh, cool. That's what I was going to ask you next is, where did you see Naked Raygun live and describe that experience?
Well, the first time I saw Naked Raygun, I didn't really know who they were. I kind of knew who Dead Kennedys was, and that's why I went to the show. And so kind of discovered them at the show, sort of. But it was a little later that I had heard, I want to say I heard the song Surf Combat. And that was the first Naked Raygun record that I heard. It was Throb Throb.
Yeah. Do you remember buying it?
I don't really remember buying it, although I do remember buying All Rise.
Yeah.
I remember that very well because I've seen them and they had played the song The Peacemaker, and I was like, I have to have this album. And I went to like 8 different record stores and finally found it at some place in Skokie and was pretty excited to have that.
Was there a particular concert that actually did it for you that cemented them in your punk history?
Probably the show where the next day I bought All Rise, right around 86, maybe 87. Yeah, it was at the Riviera.
I know there's sort of, now that you're familiar with the music, so it probably meant more because you could sing along, but
right.
Was there anything in particular there that really just, like, the energy of the show?
Well, yeah, they were just a very unique band from Chicago, so that was pretty cool. I really liked that. And it was those vocal hooks for me that really did it, and they were really kind of experimental, but at the same time, really catchy. All those elements I just really were drawn to,
yeah,
right off the bat.
For me, even though I wasn't a mosh pit person, they had one of the most intense mosh pits I'd,
yeah,
ever seen at all their shows.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
And it was pretty choreographed. Like, the whole thing would just move in a huge circle. That's
right,
what I always,
right,
remember, is that,
sure,
you didn't even want to be a part of it. You would just walk towards it, and then all of a sudden you were, like, whipped around in it.
Right, right. So I was part of all those mosh pits. I used to really be into that.
It was fun. It's fun.
Broke my arm twice because of it.
But. Did you actually?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Did that record Throb Throb affect the way you write music?
Yeah, I think it did. Like, the song I Don't Know. When I was thinking of the song Guest List, the lead for Guest List, I was really thinking of the song I Don't Know. And so, you know, little things like that, the little vocal hooks that they had, and just overall quirkiness, like, of the band was influential to me.
What are some of the things that affected you strongest about helping conduct these interviews?
It was just kind of cool to hear the stories of how each member and what they had brought to that record, because I just didn't know the story. And
yeah,
to me, it's a story of everybody really having great attributes to the record, and it really, the sum being more than its parts.
Me Naked Ray Gun is one of the bands at the forefront of Chicago's original punk scene. From a basement, they began to emerge around 1980, alongside such bands as The Effigies, Articles of Faith, Big Black, Strike Under, and Silver Abuse. Throughout the beginning years, the band went through many lineup changes and styles before cementing their solid place in punk history around their second full-length record called All Rise. The song you're hearing now is called Lie, from their first release, an EP called Basement Screams, on Ruthless Records, a label of which you will soon hear about in this podcast from the mouth of Naked Ray Gun friend, Chicago legend, producer and engineer of such bands as Jawbreaker, Nirvana, and the Stooges, musician in such bands as Big Black, Rape Man, and Shellac, Steve Albini. You will also hear sections of a few extended interviews of five members of Naked Ray Gun, who added significantly to the legend of Throb Throb, including singer Jeff Pizzotti, bassist Camilo Gonzalez, guitarist John Haggerty, and drummers Jim Coleo and Eric Spicer. And as always, these interviews will be interspersed with original pieces. A few of my good friends have spent much time contemplating the effect of Throb Throb on their lives, and they have all chosen specific songs that spoke directly to them. These pieces, first and foremost, are each writer's individual takes on how a specific song has inspired them. You will hear truths, fictions, personal tales, lyrical analytics, and biographies. And as always, this program will be dictated by the order of the songs that appear on the album that is being featured. And one more important note to make this intro even longer, I feel I must acknowledge that the legacy of Naked Ray Gun has contained other band members not interviewed here that have contributed equally to the success and longevity of this behemoth of a band. This podcast focuses its attention on a single album and concentrates on the musicians who had recorded on that record, and it traces their entrances and exits from the band. So I'd like to bow my proverbial hat to the members before and after, including Pierre Kesdy, Pete Midler, Bill Stevens, Santiago Durango, John London, Marco Pizzotti, and Bobby Strange. And now, with no further ado, Throb Throb. Just a little bit about Ruthless, since the roots of Naked Ray Gun releases seem to begin there. What, from the eyes of today, was the purpose of this label, and what did it mean to bands like Big Black and Naked Ray Gun in the day?
The most significant band in the development of the Chicago independent scene was probably the Effigies. They seemed to have their business shit together better than any of the other bands. They were aggressive about getting out of town. They had made serious recording plans earlier than most of the other bands. They had a guy, John Babin, who was a de facto manager. He was like a fifth member. He did all their booking, and essentially he was like the business member of the band. And I had contacted him. I was a occasional DJ on a college radio station at Northwestern, WNUR, and he was going to get us a copy of the Effigies record when it came out. They were talking about trying to do another record themselves, and, you know, I'd given him a copy of the Big Black demo, and he said, well, you know, if we end up starting a label, you'd be welcome to be on that label. He was also talking to Jeff from Naked Ray Gun, and all the principals got together, and we talked about the idea of, instead of having a single record label that was releasing all the records, if we just had an imprint that had a name, we could each individually do our own thing, but it would come out under the name Ruthless, and that way we would have some more perceived clout and or identity with the distributors, who were, at that point, you were kind of catering to the distributors. The independent record distributors were the people who got records from one locale into the distribution network of mom-and-pop stores. There were no real chains that were interested in independent punk records. So you needed to work with independent distributors who themselves were working with mom-and-pop stores all across the country. They were sort of geographically disparate as well as being unrelated to each other. So stores that bought from one of those companies tended not to buy from the other. No East Coast stores would be buying from Systematic or Rough Trade on the West Coast, and none of the East Coast people would be buying from them. So getting a bunch of distributors to carry your record was kind of a magic trick. You had to convince them that you were a real label. They didn't want to deal with somebody who was sketchy or flighty. But more importantly, if you were a one-off band making an independent record and you sold it to a couple of distributors, they had no incentive to pay you for the records that they just got from you if you didn't have another record coming down the pipeline that they also wanted. So we thought it was a good idea to have a number of releases scheduled and a number of releases in the pipeline so that when the first of them came out, it was more likely that that band would get paid if there were other records coming down the pipe.
Did that stay the aesthetic to the end of the label, or did that somehow change?
the label didn't survive very long. I think it was there was an initial spate of releases. Then I tried to run that label independent, like by myself. I was terrible at that. And in the end, I just had to give up. I was like, I don't have the time to manage it. I don't have the time to sell the records. I don't want to be responsible to other people. So I just gave everybody their masters back, and whatever inventory we could get out of Dutch East, I got out of them, and I gave that to the band.
Track one is Rat Patrol, written by John Haggerty. Are credited as the writer of Rat Patrol. What is the song based on?
Well, I named it after one of my favorite TV shows as a kid, Rat Patrol. It's like from the 60s. It's a show about, you know, it's like an army show. It's about the long-range desert group. They used to drive around in Jeeps and shoot up Rommel's fuel dumps and stuff. They made a series out of it. So I thought it would be a good title for a song that, you know, kind of relates to how fucked up things are in that region of the world, and how, you know, how long it's been that way.
Yeah, and keeps repeating itself too.
Yeah, and it never goes away.
It really doesn't. That was funny just reading those lyrics the other day. I was thinking that I was like, wow, this still goes on. You know.
Yeah, it's just like, it's perfect example of history, just knowing history and how easy it is to predict the future if you just know a little bit about history, especially about that particular area.
What influenced you to pick up an instrument, and were these the same influences that made you consider being in a band?
Actually, no, to the second part. The first part is what made me pick up an instrument, I guess, was when I first saw Led Zeppelin. You know, you gotta remember, I go back a ways, so when I first picked up a guitar was before punk rock, so I was looking at guys like Jimmy Page and Tony Iommi from Black Sabbath, Thin Lizzy and Deep Purple. That kind of stuff, that's what I got started on. But the other half of that is they in no way inspired me to have a band, because I never thought I could be that good. My way of thinking back then was you had to be like a Jimmy Page or a, you know, or Jeff Beck or somebody to make records. You know, you had to be like, you know, almost like a god to even consider being in a band, which was a really stupid way of thinking, you know. Which I later found out through punk rock.
Right, yeah, I never thought of that, but I can remember being a little kid thinking that too, that you had to have like skills like Jimi Hendrix or something like
yeah.
that in order to even do it at all. And I find that really interesting as well. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think all three of us had that, because my influences were like UFO and Shanker and all those earlier.
UFO, yeah, I left him out, yeah.
Yeah, I could never do those solos, so it was the same thing for me. And then I finally found sort of the... not only the punk, but the garage bands, too, that just played, like, power chords.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was like a revelation, really, when I first saw... I can remember exactly when it happened. I saw Strike Under at O'Banion's, and I was like, man, this is really good, but on the other hand, this is something that I could do, too, you know? And it really, like, clicked. It snapped in my mind right then and there.
Track 2, Surf Combat, was written by Camilo Gonzalez.
Surf Combat was really the second song that I wrote. I wrote it while waiting in line in a Ramones concert with Bill, helping me out a few lines. So I played it years before with Raygun. John did a lot of justice to it, as did the rest of the guys.
Where were you raised?
Yeah, I was born in Havana. Yeah, born in Havana, lived in the suburbs until about 5. And then we flew over to Miami and stayed there for a year, and now I'm in Chicago.
Do you have many memories of living elsewhere, or does it mostly start with Chicago for you?
I have vivid memories of living in Cuba. It seemed like a tropical version of Wisconsin, and everything was just obscenely verdant. And we, like I said, we lived out in the burbs. We had a almond orchard next to our place, and we would pick the almonds and break them open with a hammer, and it was the best almond taste I've ever tasted. We had chickens and rabbits, and it was kind of a fairly pastoral existence for the suburbs.
Were you raised properly, like in the city, or you're like a suburban when you came to Chicago?
we moved into Newtown when we first came here, and it was a pretty rough area.
You want to kill.
What influenced you to pick up an instrument?
In my case, I think it was very rhythmic. We used to go out in high school to the park and maybe do a little drinking. And we had something called the stick band, and we would all pick up varying sticks, which would have varying tones, and hit on the ground and sing. And this was our proto band. And later, a lot of us went on to play instruments, and I think I still retain kind of that rhythmic quality, you know, that primal quality. And I think that's probably what attracted me to punk.
Track 3 is Gear with Jeff Pizzati.
When you're writing for Naked Ray Gun, does it sort of dictate how you're writing, or do you feel you can just write whatever you want in terms of lyrics?
Later on in years, I felt like I was writing for Naked Ray Gun. Like the last two albums, I felt like I was niche writing, which kind of bothered me because it limits you on what you can do, and you feel kind of pressured. First couple albums by any band are brilliant because they have a load of songs to choose from, you know. You just pick and choose your best ones, and they come out great because you have 30 songs to pick 15 out of. They're brilliant. And then later on in the years, you know, you're going back and you're saying, well, Hot Atomics isn't such a bad song. We should put that on there. We recorded it once. But the first couple albums, everything you write is brilliant. And the least you know about writing songs, sometimes the better your music is.
I guess what Dan was really curious as to the difference between what actually makes someone interested in music, like either be a vocalist or pick up a guitar, and is that different from what actually drives you to be in a band?
Yeah, I think it is. I think people play guitars and sit around their house and play a lot of basements and never leave there, and then there's another to take the big step to go out and play in front of an audience and be in a regular band and be out in front of people. But I was in a lot of basement bands and never played in front of anybody. Played before there was punk rock and played. I was in one band that played all Stone songs because the guitar player knew all Stone songs. And another band that played like James Gang songs. It was horrible. And I was in another band and all these bands never played, left the basement, you know. Never had even names for the bands. But a lot of talented people in these groups, but they just never had. They never knew really how to get out of the basement, you know. And I learned how to play guitar at the YMCA. When I was like 9 years old, there was a folk teacher who taught acoustic guitar, and I learned how to play guitar. And then after that was over, I never picked up a guitar until I was like 16. Then I started playing guitar again. But you know, it taught me not to be afraid of the guitar, and it taught me the basic chords and all that. And so then, you know, it's just a lot of sitting around in your bedroom playing. And I was in a band, was going to play out, probably try to play out live finally. And that's the band that Dan loves, that Condor. My parents had bookshelf speakers, and they were just about head level with me at that point. It was about 5'6" off the ground, and a big wall-mounted rack thing that they used to have at my parents' house. And I used to blast UFO and Cheap Trick and try to sing along right into the speaker and try to sing that high, which is kind of tough because I don't have that kind of vocal range as those guys, but I would try to get up there. And then Condor played out a couple times, and then punk rock thing hit, and then it was all over for me. I cut my hair and joined the movement.
Do you remember a specific band that you saw or something that really pushed it over the edge for you?
I remember a band I heard. I only saw them twice later on in years, but what really did it for me was the Dead Boys. My brother would bring home Clash records and Sex Pistols records and Stranglers records, and he would send stuff home from college. He was a couple years older than me, and he would send home he would send the jam home. But what really did it for me was when I heard the Dead Boys, when I heard Sonic Reducer and that whole first album, it really clicked, and I just loved it. It's so well produced. I still listen to it today, and it's such a good record.
What came first for you? Was it seeing the band Naked Ray Gun, or did you know someone? And what were the circumstances of those meetings?
Yeah, I went to go see them. I saw them a couple of times. They opened for Bauhaus at Space Place. That was an insane show. I saw them at, it was at COD. That's where it was, which is a downstairs place on Rogers Park or in Uptown. Yeah, I saw them a couple of times, and they were instantly my favorite band. Like, totally, completely insane. By the time I'd seen them three or four times, I still didn't know what kind of a band they were, because their shows were really different. Like, every time they did a show, they would have some kind of a conceit about the show. Like, they did one show where they played at the Cubby Bear, where they, instead of having a normal stage with a PA, they'd set up four little areas in the corners of the bar, and each of them played in his own corner. Like, you'd see them one time, and it would sound kind of like rockabilly music, you know, and they'd all have, like, pompadours. And then you'd see him again, and it would kind of sound like Bow Wow Wow, you know, with all the tribal drumming and a lot of hooting and hollering and stomping and clapping. Then you'd see him again, and it would kind of sound like the Misfits, like with a lot of like sing-along anthemic punk rock kind of stuff. They gradually sort of stabilized into that mode, like that is more of like a permanent mode. But in the beginning, like when they were first doing shows, like I saw them they had a synthesizer player at one of these shows, a guy that had a synthesizer, but I don't think he knew how to play keyboards. So it was just sort of going every now and again, you know, like shit like that. Just every time I saw them, it completely changed my impression of what the band was. They had a demo tape that was getting played on ZRD a lot, and I saw them playing this one show where they were all obviously high as kites. I don't know what they were on, but they were like barely communicating, and they seemed to be like sort of walking through a fog, you know, like they couldn't really, nobody was moving normally. People were shouting requests for these songs from this demo, and Jeff just shot every one of them down, like, no, we're not playing it. And they played a bunch of like really like freeform noisy stuff. I totally love that band. I could not have had a better introduction to how awesome it could be to have your own band. Because I had just moved here to Chicago from Montana, and I didn't really know what went on in a city that had a band culture. It was a really great introduction to that kind of like self-defining mentality. And it took me a long time to actually work up the courage to approach Jeff and talk to him. The first time I spoke to him was after John Babin had already had a copy of the Big Black demo tape. And he said, hey, Jeff Pizzotti has your demo tape. And he liked it. And he said he wanted to talk to you. I probably would not have ever worked up the nerve to approach him if he hadn't made like an overt gesture of appreciation through John Babin to me.
Camilo Gonzalez.
Metastasis, I wrote with Sant in the basement. That was an extraordinarily fertile time for us. I mean, there were too many songs put on Throb Throb. We had to throw a bunch of stuff out.
And now, Chicago performer, writer, and director Steve Walker will talk about track 4, Metastasis.
I am a fetus. I am a tumor. I am the local slime mold. Look, it was 1985. MTV was in full command, back when they still played videos. Punk, for all its intents and purposes in the mainstream, was long dead. Except it wasn't. It just moved underground. Bands were being formed, hardcore was on the rise. Soon the tide would turn the other way. The 90s would come, bringing with it a new bullshit alternative rock to the American consumer. But for now, the lines were drawn. So, if you were a high school student in the northwest suburbs of Chicago in 1985, Arlington Heights to be exact, Naked Ray Gun were absolutely essential. Having grown up in the city, I was, by midway through high school, exiled to the burbs. I was a budding rock obsessive, poring over record guides in the library. I recall being a purist around then. For me, It was either older weird shit or new obscure shit. Everything on the radio sucked ass. My friends and I would trade knowledge, tapes, and records with each other. My friend Paul Leckie was probably the first one to play me Throb Throb. Some of our friends would go on to form a band called Product 19, whose members included Bill Stevens, who would later join up with Naked Raygun. Our local was Dirty Nellies and another place, I think called The Rainbow, and we'd see bands, some of them our friends. Arlington Heights was a long way from Chicago, so I didn't have much opportunity to get back into the city. But when we would, we'd go to all-ages shows at the Metro and the Cubby Bear. One of the first shows I saw was Naked Raygun. I remember getting into the pit during Metastasis. Normally, I would stay out in the periphery, but I had to get in there. It's one of my favorite songs. I broke my glasses and got a black eye. It was glorious. The guy I couldn't take my eyes off of was John Haggerty. He barely moved. His guitar sounded like no other hardcore guitar I'd heard. Just pure, fill-in-your-own-cliched buzzsaw description. I just couldn't get over how much ferocious sound was coming from this solitary man. Years later, I would get drunk with him at the Old Town Alehouse. He was cagey about his days with the band, and we ended up talking about other shit. But I was honored to tip a few back with him that afternoon. I would get into a lot of bands in the intervening years, but Naked Raygun would always be one of my favorites. In my opinion, the best band to ever come out of Chicago. It's important to support your local bands, and Chicago is lucky to have one of the greatest American punk bands to call their own. I cherish them like an Italian beef sandwich and the son of Sven Gulli.
Jim Kaleo on track 5.
Leeches and Roller Queen, they were actually arranged by me from various people's parts.
How would you go about arranging?
I had this jazzy beat that I had been experimenting with, and Santiago, although he wasn't in the band anymore, I had heard him playing a little guitar riff months, maybe even a year earlier, but it stuck in my head. So I asked him, hey, can I do something with that riff? I got a drum beat it would go with. And he said, sure. So I played the beat. John learned the guitar riff. And Camilo I just said, come up with something on bass, you know. And we're just going over it in a kind of a loop. And Camilo came up with a little jazzy bass line. It was a total collaboration.
Well, I never seen a war. No, I never caught pneumonia. I never knew my mom's son. I knew my mom's not leeches.
I guess the AM rock music in the mid-60s, there were a lot of groups that just had, I remember Dave Clark 5 had this, they always had this big drum roll as a break. I just always wanted to play that drum roll. So when I was 9, I had this friend whose parents bought them virtually every toy and gadget that was around. So one day I went to his house and there's a drum kit, you know, a little toy drum kit and plastic organs and guitars and little toy amps. I didn't see anybody sitting at the drums, so I said, can I play the drums? And they said, sure. And that was it. It just was like putting on a glove, basically.
Who did you meet first?
Well, in early, in mid-70s, I was in U of I art school, and Camilo Gonzalez was also in some design classes. So we actually hung out in art school, and late 76, there was another guy there, Al Zopinski, who wasn't in, he was just into buying records a lot. So he bought every new release that was coming out on the independent side, and also had recorded probably 100 or so of his punk records to 8-track tape. So he actually had an 8-track player, and we would crank it up in art school 2-3 in the morning, and some of us had actually carved out little living spaces there, so we were squatting in the art building. Right around that time, Silver Buse formed, so I met everybody in the band there, including Santiago. And when they broke up around 79, there was a summer where I could still get into the art school because I'd been a volunteer security guard, so I could just call up and get late night access to the building. So Santiago and had found a couple of interesting punks hanging around or alternative because they weren't really. Well, one guy had his, he had dyed his hair kind of like a leopard skin. His name is Felix. The other guy was Max Gray, who is hopefully resting in peace these days, but he played a noise synth, and I bashed on some drum kit that some friends had bought me about a year earlier for $100, a three-piece drum kit, so there's no floor tom, so and Santiago just played some noise, and we just annoyed the hell out of the people in the art building because I wasn't even a student there anymore, and they were trying to have class or work on their projects, and we were just making some god-awful noise. But the project didn't go anywhere, but it was the first, that was technically the first band that I had played together with Santiago for that summer in 79.
I was in a band called Silver Abuse with Santiago, the guy who originally formed Naked Raygun. And we kind of went in different musical directions, I guess. And Marco Pizzati, Jeff's brother, quit, or he wanted to quit, and Santiago recruited me for the band.
Where did you meet Santiago?
I met Santiago freshman year in high school when I asked to borrow a brush from him in art school. In our class, and I forgot, he gave me some really goofy answer, but he lent it to me, so we became friends.
It was kind of weird. They had my brother had met Santiago Durango, and they were playing at the practice space where the Way Outs practice, which was Camilo and Jim Paleo and Paul Shabala and Bill Meehan, Stopping Billy Bosco, in other words, was his nickname, and Alzo is a guitar player. They practiced the same space those guys practiced at. Later became Silver Abuse. But my brother and Santiago practiced there just working on songs themselves for quite a while, probably for about 6 months. And I'm still in the suburban band, and I hadn't moved to the city yet. So they were working on songs that Santiago had wrote. And then they actually came and saw the band I was in play Beginnings one day.
He used to be in a band called Condor before we found him, a suburb cover band. First time I saw him, he had a huge afro, and he was wearing like these vertically striped bell bottoms. But to his credit, the man can sing.
Later on at O'Banion's, he said, "You should cut your hair and join our band." So I went to their couple of their practices. I thought, these guys really suck, man. They can really play. But there's something about them, they have such true, it's like it was really pure, really true and pure, no bullshit, no posing or anything, and they had such funk, so I joined them, and we were just a three-piece, and we played out once without a drummer, a three-piece, at a loft party, at a practice space, actually. We got raided by the cops, and because the guy we invited, this giant black guy, got insulted racially by this kid with a dog collar named Rover, and he punched him out, and Rover was knocked out before his head hit the concrete. Then when his head hit the concrete, there was blood all over. And then they brought the paramedics in, and the paramedics said, "We're not going in this space. There's too many crazy-ass people there." So then they brought the cops in, so the paramedics could grab Rover and throw him on the ambulance. So the party was pretty much over. That was our first show. We played as Negro Commando.
I can't remember who I actually met first. We all used to hang around at the same bar, so it was inevitable that everybody knew, eventually got to know everybody else. But Santiago had an idea for a song with a saxophone on it, and somehow it got around that I played saxophone in the grade school band, so therefore I was the most qualified candidate, so they had me come in and play saxophone on Swingo on that first EP, and that's how I got involved with those guys. And then they later realized that I could play guitar, and decided to go with the two guitar thing shortly after that, and that unfortunately didn't last very long. Santiago left not too long after that. I think we only might have played one or two gigs with the two guitar lineup.
When I first started interacting with them on a personal level, as opposed to just being a fan going to shows, was at the period where Santiago was leaving the band and John Haggerty was just working his way in. I saw a couple of shows during that transitional period where they had both Santiago and John playing guitar, and those were by far the best of the hard rock type Naked Ray Gun shows that I saw. Before John joined the band, they had a lot of different ways of playing all their songs, and it seemed like they were enjoying the sort of the confusion and the and confounding effect of playing everything differently every time they played. But then when John joined the band, it seemed like initially Jeff and Jim Kaleo were kind of the creative forces behind the band. And then Camilo joined, and I think Camilo started to contribute some songwriting stuff. And then John Haggerty joined, and that's when they sort of stabilized into the kind of band playing the kind of music that they sort of carried on doing forever.
You just heard from Steve Albini, and before that was track number 6, Roller Queen. You will now hear track number 7, On, created by Camilo Gonzalez. You will first hear from Camilo, and then you will hear from Eric T. Roth, who is a Chicago native, writer, and sketch performer. He will carry us on into track 8, I Don't Know. Now I'm going to ask about that track, On. What was behind that?
Well, I was going out with a girl who had this turntable that I would play backwards. And I thought, you know, why not? We recorded this silly little song and put it on the track backwards, and never really expecting people to play it forward. And now that it's on CD, it's not too easy. I don't know, maybe like an Easter egg or something.
I'm good at walking. Despite hip cartilage tears and flimsy ankles, I'm good at walking. Aided by headphones, I find myself 15 minutes from work, angry, pissed at fucking everything. Politicians, healthcare policies, people with dogs. It's the music. The music does it to me. It makes me want to blow some shit up. Those experiments with scientists playing Mozart and the rats found the cheese quicker. They played Metallica and the rats ate themselves. I'd fucking eat myself if I had to listen to Metallica. I'd fucking eat a rat. By the time I hear the song, it's over. Rage has set in, and then it's done. Then, thank God, a beautiful punk ballad pops on. Everyone talks of the death of vinyl, the death of the album, the death of song juxtaposition, and the emotional journey. Side A, side B, sigh. I can understand why. Most tracks on my iPod are shuffled and scattered. A purist fucking nightmare. Someone spent a lot of time ordering this shit, and here goes modern technology fucking it all up again. The older I get, the more I realize how duped I was to believe in youth the way I did. I used to think the generational disconnect was the same thing as power, that at some point the adults would all die and we would take control, run the whole world. The foolish old guard could suck a big old unconventional-looking dick. It's prefabricated, though. Those who wrangle our media made sure punk would become a wrapping paper for the same garbage on TV, the stuff punk claimed to critique. Youth Brigade just became an angrier version of the Parent Trap. I don't know. I remember going to the premiere of You Weren't There, the documentary of 80s Chicago punk. The film ends with a bunch of old folks talking about how kids suck today. I don't know, I'd be bummed too if I suddenly realized that I was the villain in a made-for-TV Disney movie. Stupid old people, the protagonist would say, flipping on his iPod and blasting Naked Ray Gun. These guys get it, he would say to the cheerleader. She would feel so graced in his subversive presence. Do the youth have it bad? A fucking course. Is it all old people's faults? Abso-fucking-lutely. But the more we sit around blaming, complaining, waxing nostalgic, and indulging in inflammatory writ instead of killing those damn politicians and healthcare policies and people with dogs... I found myself listening to quieter music on the way to work. If I keep showing up sweaty and pissed, they're gonna grow suspicious. Am I getting old? I don't know.
In incredible album, the best Naked Ray Gun record, easily. The single that came out prior to it was also awesome, and that's the closest to encapsulating the live sound of that band during that period. Because Jeff had had such a good time working with Ian Burgess on that record, he recommended that I start, that I talk to Ian about working on the Big Black records, and Ian and I became lifelong friends as a result of Jeff suggesting that I talk to him after having worked with him for the on the Throb Throb record. I don't know that I would have ever crossed paths with Ian otherwise. Ian eventually ended up becoming the go-to guy for all the Chicago bands, and a huge influence on me as an engineer and just as a dude, the way he conducted himself with the bands and, you know, his just sort of total immersion and appreciation for the band culture that he was participating in. A huge influence. I can't overstate his influence, really. And also a great friend. Like, he went out of his way to help all the bands in Chicago generally, and me specifically, way, way more than he needed to.
Yeah, John, we were also curious, why did you choose to use Ian Burgess? You know, how did you come to know him?
I met Ian at the Cubby Bear way back when we used to do the Cubby Bear, whenever that was, like 82-ish or something. We hit it off really well, and we seemed to agree on a lot of stuff. You know, back in those days, loud guitars were unmanageable by most engineer standards, you know. They just could not deal with them, you know, in any way.
And he encouraged that, I take it?
Yeah, he understood that. He understood that guitars have to be loud. He got that totally, which at that time especially, nobody understood that. No engineer understood that.
So did he help kind of help cultivate that guitar sound that you were known for?
Yeah, well, I mean, he didn't ask me to turn down, you know, and that's pretty much all it took. And yeah, and he did encourage me to do things like, you know, put the guitar in like an empty corridor or like a bathroom or something, you know, and turn it up, you know, really fucking loud and see what that sounds like. And it sounded pretty good.
And the bass for you, was there any effect or any difference that recording with him?
Well, I thought I got kind of short-shrifted on the bass on that record. I might have not have been the best bass player then, and they didn't want to do too many takes. So, you know, there's a couple of flubs that you can notice. But, no, I mean, I'm sorry, Ian, but I don't think I got the best bass sound I could have gotten. It was too fine of mid-range for my taste.
Bass and Screams was recorded with Timothy Powell out of an industrial studio in Des Plaines. We did a lot of industry stuff like here's how to work a steam press, here's how to work a film projector kind of stuff. So the studio wasn't really set up for a lot of music, I don't think. And Timothy did a good job with Bass and Screams. But as far as like somebody who appreciated the rock, we were told Ian Burgess was the guy to go to, and he immediately became a friend and was really super interested and super gung-ho.
I'm just wondering if you saw any difference on how the vocals were recorded from using Ian.
No, I've never been happy with the early records with the backup vocals on any of it, either Albini's stuff that he did with us or on Burgess's stuff. The main vocal I was always really happy with, but none of those guys paid attention enough to the backup vocals. I really thought those could be really giant chants, like Jam 69 or somebody. But he did a great job on the rest of it. He did a wonderful job on the guitar, that's for sure.
Ian was, an excitable fellow, or at least I think with us, he was maybe still honing his craft. And he was busily trying all these things. Oh, what if we put this microphone here and then put the... And we were recording in a house, so he had John in the bathroom, and he put a microphone in the bathroom with John, and then he put a microphone and a stairwell midway, and then another one all the way at the top. And he's like a little kid twiddling all these knobs. Oh, it's natural reverb. It's the room. He got a great sound. And all in all, I just remember he was a very professional guy, very funny, very patient. And I think he was able to pull, you know, a pretty good recording session out of us.
Ian Burgess died in France on February 11th, 2010, of a pulmonary embolism, a complication of pancreatic and liver cancer. Coleo. Libido.
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Is there anything you'd like to speak to about libido? Because you're credited for the full writing of that song.
Yeah, I mean, it's an example of, you know, most of my songs had some tongue-in-cheek lyric line. I was never one to wear my emotions on my shirt sleeves or, you know, cry in my beer kind of thing. there was always something just crazy, you know, experiencing things now. And you know, it was just a tongue-in-cheek way of, you know, saying, hey, you know, you could party too much and, you know, it could have consequences.
Jeff, we were always wondering whether this was something that the audience has brought into it, but it's also often talked about how the band is like a blue-collar, working-class band. Is that a persona that you guys were feeding into, or is that something that just was perceived from the outside?
Well, before that, we had a look of rockabilly guys, and the Rock Hats would play town. My brother went to see the Rock Hats and said, are you sure we can't be a rockabilly band now? He came back from Rock Hats show. Then I saw the Rock Hats and said, damn, those guys are fucking cool. They all got cool hair and chicks are all over them and music is pretty cool. Guys are climbing on their basses and on their drums. They got fucking Jerry Nolan playing the drums for them from the New York Dolls on their first tour. So we went out and got pointy everything, first of all, before we went to combat route. I had so many pairs of black pointy Puerto Rican toque corner stomping roach killers boots that you wouldn't even, I still have them all too. All the Beetle boots stuff. And we took our pants and we couldn't sew, but we learned how to use a sewing machine. We took the pockets out of the front pockets so they would hug our hips closer so it looked skinnier, you know.
Yeah.
I made pants you couldn't even get on. They had to like literally like run in from across the room and jump in them. And we wore a lot of pink with our collars up, pink button-down shirts with our collars up, and we didn't know what we were doing. We were American our own style for a while there. And then the combat thing came in with Haggerty. He insisted on wearing combat stuff, so he didn't really coerce us into doing it. It kind of just drifted that way. I bought some paratrooper pants, and they're just easy to get a hold of. We started wearing combat stuff, and flat tops seemed pretty cool, so we did that.
And now about John Haggerty's cool style. Did you consider your persona on stage as a character, or was it just you?
You know, I think it's pretty much just me. I don't think I'm doing anything, you know, that doesn't come natural to me. In fact, it's pretty boring if you look at it.
Well, there was always sort of a cool air about the band. And even, I mean, you're playing, too. The cigarette hanging there, or, you know. It's weird, because I don't usually talk about this with bands, but I think you were such an influence on me and Babbitt that we sort of took notice of that, sort of, those sort of things.
Yeah, you tend to take notice of just about everything when you're kind of coming from our point of view. probably stuff that, you know, you wouldn't even consider, but like those are the kind of things that would stick out, you know, when we were growing up watching the band. Like, oh, he always plays with a cigarette in his mouth. That's cool.
I ripped that off from Jimmy Page. I saw him playing with a cigarette in his mouth once, and I thought it looked cool, so I started doing it. Yeah, I mean,
and come to think of it, I can totally picture that now with Jimmy Page.
Yeah.
I remember being a kid, always, you know, going through Hit Parade or magazine and Kerrang, and some of those pics had a Jimmy Page with a cigarette in his mouth. So yeah, that's pretty funny.
I just rip off people. That's all I do.
Well, that's it. You got to make it your own. Some people rip it off and then they're just imitating, but some people add their own personality to it. So, congratulations.
Well, thanks. You just got to know what to rip off, I guess.
Was any of the image of the band intentional to Naked Ray Gun, or did it just was more of the punk style of the time? Was that worked on at all?
Well, like in specific, like the flat tops and there was the combat boots and...
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, in a way, maybe it was worked on a little bit. You know, I didn't want to look like a punk, you know, like a mohawk, a blue mohawk punk or any of that. But then I didn't want to look like, you know, some schmo either. But so I don't know. In a way, maybe it was worked on a little bit, you know, just as something to set us apart, maybe.
Was it? Yeah, I know some of the songs are fairly political about the wars and soldiers. Was there any part of that to sort of resemble that in a way? I always wondered. There always seemed to sort of a very clean-cut soldier-like fashion to it.
I do have a lot of respect for veterans. I always have. And, you know, to some degree, I think I wanted to reflect that, you know, both in the music and maybe in the way we presented ourselves. You know, the first time we flew into to London, security thought we were SAS.
Well, you did it. You pulled it off.
They did, yeah. They were looking us up and down pretty good.
Do you recall a change in the audience reaction to the band after Throb Throb was released?
Yes. At that time, the emphasis had become more on American bands and not so much on British ones. You know, there were bands like Husker Du, us, the New York bands. So we were treated quite well after that. You know, we were invited to play at Peppermint Lounge. That's the time that they flew us out. The album did fairly well, but it did seem to mark a huge step in our popularity and our exposure. Spin reviewed it, and after we released the record, I think somebody called it the most seminal record since The Clash. And, you know, well, of course, they're given to hyperbole, but I appreciated it.
I mean, I used to do things around Chicago, like, to get our name out there. Every single show, I used to go out myself and just poster until I couldn't stay awake anymore at night. I used to post to the lamppost with flour and glue. I used to go to all the high schools, whether the high school kids went or not. I used to do Gordon Tech, Lane Tech. I still have posters that say on the top of them, Dead Kennedys, Black Flag, Misfit. If you like these bands, you will love this band. You will love this band, Naked Ray Gun. And the people, just to get people's attention to read the thing, you know. I lived at the time next to this place. It was the L ran by, and they had this fence up. So you couldn't go underneath the L by the sidewalk. A big, long wooden fence next to keep you from going underneath, walking underneath the L by the street. And I got in my van. I drove in. I parked it right next to this big, long wooden fence. I had this giant piece of wallpaper that was really plain, one huge, long length of it. And I spray painted on there like Naked Ray Gun Rules or something. It was so long, and I was all by myself, and I just said, fuck it, I'm just going to run out there and stick this. It's like 10 o'clock at night, no one's going to stop me. Who's going to fucking stop me? I just ran out there, I put glue on the whole wall, ran out there and started sticking it up on the wall. It was this immense thing, it was gigantically huge, and I got it all up and everything, and nobody stopped me. I got back in my van, and I took off. That thing was up there for like a month. People would tear at it a little bit as they all walked by, you know. The pieces of it were up there for a month. It was really satisfying, you know, see your name in print, even though you did it yourself.
If you were to step back and look at that record, removed from yourself, what is its place in punk music, or even just in Chicago?
Well, what I do remember a couple of the reviews that came out in 85, one in Spin magazine, where the reviewer just raved about the guitar work, the drumming, the song arrangements, taking chances. And so after seeing what was going on at that time, a lot of the earliest punk bands had either died out or transmorphed into Euro dance bands. And then on the other hand, you had non-melodic hardcore scene and speed punk scene coming on. So Throb Throb stood like in the middle of all of that, those things which continued to evolve. So it was more like something that was still set apart, still had like kind of some of the renegade punk aspects of early punk, but with just enough of the experimental side thrown in. So there was never, I think a lot of people liked it because, you know, from song to song, you were getting a different flavor, a different slice of the pie, you know. Every song didn't sound the same at that point.
Do you recall any strong memories about rehearsing for Throb Throb?
I don't know. I mean, there were so many nights. I just remember getting home from work, taking the bus over to the coach house where we rehearsed, and being in the studio with Sant, working on songs and drinking cheap wine and working on songs, laughing hysterically like kids.
Well, the funny thing is, I'm only in America, the second verse, I wrote the first line, Camilo wrote the second line, Santiago wrote the third line, and Pizzotti wrote the final line about dipping your boogers in your car. So technically that's some kind of co-authorship of lyrics, but I'm the one who wrote the music.
I I think we were in the right place at the right time for a lot of it. I mean, I think there were bands that were better. I mean, like, Strike Under was writing songs with verses and choruses and bridges, and we were just writing songs where we just screamed the whole thing, you know, one riff, and I didn't know how to write a punk song. They listened to the Adolescents, Christ, they were writing real songs, but we would write songs that were really simple.
I think it goes back to, like, what you were talking about earlier. You said that maybe to not know is the best route, because I think it definitely worked very, very well with you guys, and it continued to. So if you guys didn't know how to write a song, the result was awesome.
Yeah. We would do stuff visually. Like, one time before Smart Bar was called Smart Bar, it was called Waves. Santiago, we played in front of 20 people, and Santiago took his SG over his head at the last song and smashed it on the ground. This beautiful SG, and started jumping up and down, and I thought it was all broken pieces. And then I looked at the audience and I said, well, that is our last song. Inexplicably. I mean, for no reason at all. Like, there's only 20 people there. Word gets around when you do shit like that, you know? And then one time Santiago said, we all have to dye our hair blonde. I didn't ask him why. I just said, okay, when do we do it? It was a show. My brother showed up with blonde hair, and Santiago and I were living in the coach house with each other. And I dyed his hair blonde. I bleached his hair blonde. He bleached my hair blonde, and it wasn't white enough. So I bleached his hair blonde again, and his hair started to fall out in chunks. Because, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. We left it in too long, and we just had this industrial-grade hair bleach stuff. So I said, I think we should stop, because I got humped with your hair in my hands, and your hair's pretty white anyway. Then we showed up and played all with blonde hair. I don't know if that did anything or not, but it looked pretty cool.
The history of Throb Throb, it was recorded in summer of 83, mastered, and then the artwork finished. In February of 84, I kind of asked at a band rehearsal, I was like, hey, what's up with Throb Throb? We just played 3 holiday shows. We should have enough money to get it pressed. How much do we need? And I was told $1,200. So I said, well, we must have $1,200. Just played 3 holiday shows. And then I was told that instead of releasing Throb Throb, Pizzotti decided to buy a new PA system, mixing board and speakers and the whole work, literally spent over $2,000 of the band money. And when I heard that, I was livid. I was baffled why we weren't releasing Throb Throb. I even suggested that we each kick in $300 and just get Throb Throb released immediately and reimburse ourselves after it started selling. I couldn't get anybody to back me up and see what a ridiculous idea that was to spend the money on a practice PA that we didn't need since we already had one. Then a few months later, I'm told that the band wants to go on a mini West Coast tour. And I'm like, why? Throb Throb hasn't been released. You're not going to have any new records to sell. Why don't you just wait 4 or 5 months? Let's release Throb Throb now. And then after it's been promoted, I'll quit my job and we can go on a tour. And I thought it was a bad business decision to go on a self-paid tour in a broken down van without Throb Throb having been in the stores for a few months. But again, nobody could see the logic in that. And they basically insisted on going on the tour without me. So that was it.
Eric, I'm trying to get my history straight. Was Throb Throb already out by the time you were in the band?
Yeah, I joined. It was recorded but not released.
That's what I figured. That's what I thought. That's why I was also interested in getting you. Because you actually probably experienced the after effects of the release more than Kaleo had or other people that have been in the band before you.
Yeah.
Did you sort of experience it going from a smaller band to larger audiences?
Oh, for sure, yeah, because when that record was released, like as we were touring everything, College Radio was really picked up on it. We owe a great deal of our success to College Radio, as well as like Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot. They both, you know, they were always really big supporters of the band too. But I would say, you know, we get tons of College Radio interviews and play a lot of college towns. We always got big support like that.
Track 12, Stupid.
How then did you end up in Naked Ray Gun?
Somehow I heard that Jim quit and Deviate had broken up by then, and I really wanted to get into another band. I thought, oh, these guys would be fun to play with. So I got a hold of Jeff. I said, hey, you know, can I try out? He's like, yeah, sure. Show up on, you know, whatever afternoon. So I went over there, brought my drums. We played for a little bit, and he said, well, show up on whatever day again. And I showed up, and this
kept happening, and we just kept playing together and playing together. And the next thing I know, we're playing a show. I was never officially made a member. I mean, you know, I could be replaced at any day now.
Eric, what is Naked Ray Gun?
Naked Ray Gun is a pain in my ass.
Can I quote you on that?
Please do.
For the last track of the album, track 13, Managua, you will hear first Camilo, and then you will hear Jim DeRogatis, a journalist and radio personality, waxing on about Managua.
Well, Managua was written right before we finished the record. It was kind of a takeoff on a song called I Hate the World. We just made it this big sloppy jam.
All right, when it comes to Naked Ray Gun and Throb Throb, I'm going to wax a little more personal than I did when I talked about the Feelies in Juggy's last podcast. And I trust you won't tell anybody, dear podcast listener, about this story because it's potentially sort of embarrassing. The first time that I saw Naked Ray Gun, it probably was the first time they came to New York. I'm living in Hoboken, New Jersey. I'm hanging with the mighty Jim Testa of Jersey Beat. We're both Ernest Young fanzine writers. Naked Ray Gun comes. We had fallen in love with Throb Throb. What a sound. And we had read a cover story in this great fanzine, Matter Magazine. Jim and I think, already were contributing to Matter from Hoboken and Weehawken. Eventually, its editor would relocate in Weehawken, and we'd contribute even more. But they had done a cover story when they were still based in Chicago, and it was Liz Phillip editing the magazine and Steve Albini waxing rhapsodic about Albini-like things. They had done a cover story on Naked Ray Gun. And these guys, in our imaginations, and, well, heck, in the photographs, they were all 7 feet tall. They were all impossibly handsome. They were chiseled. They were, like, cut in granite. I'll never forget, I think the story was writing about Camilo Gonzalez, the bass player, about how, you know, so that he could look his maximum GQ handsomest, how he'd plug an electric razor into the spare outlet in the back of his bass head and shave right before the band played. You know? These guys, who were they? And those songs were so massive, and that guitar sound was so distinct, and those drums, I mean, there were a lot of touch points. You know, we heard Wire, we heard Buzzcocks, we heard Stiff Little Fingers, but these guys were different. They were from Chicago. They had those broad shoulders. They were 7 feet tall. They were handsome, and they were singing about things that mattered very much now in the present, but they weren't doing it in that pretentious, kind of joyless Los Angeles hardcore punk way, okay? The song I'm getting to is Managua. There are only 4 lines of lyric, and 2 of them are the same. Gee whiz, pretty, pretty boys, pretty, pretty boys, onward to Managua. Ronald Reagan, you know, he was on the wall of my bedroom in that famous poster with the nuclear clock, the clock that was ticking to nuclear Armageddon. Reagan had given, it was doing a radio address, and thought that it would be interesting to check the mic by saying, "In 5 minutes, we begin bombing Russia."
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
You know, everybody thinks of him as the jovial grandfather. He was a disgusting right-wing warmonger who ruined this country, arguably still to this day, in many, many ways, in terms of the social safety net and politics and the war hawk aspect. Anyway, we were convinced we were all going to get shipped off to Nicaragua to fight Reagan's war with the Sandinistas and the imagined communist threat. And in 4 lines of lyric, only 3 of which don't repeat themselves, you know, Jeff Pizzotti, who he was even taller than the other guys. The other guys were 7 feet tall. He was 8 and a half. You know, leaning out over that stage at Maxwell's with that microphone stand, and you felt like he was right in your face, because he was. He was so big and lanky. Singing those words over and over, that chant, it meant something. And it meant something especially, here's the personal revelation, when the first time you saw Naked Ray Gun, you happened to be high on acid. In my mind, they played no other song that night. They just played Managua again and again and again. And it rang and it rang. And still to this day, you know, this was not a bad trip. It had disturbing elements, obviously. I did not want to go to Nicaragua. I was afraid about it. But, you know, in my mind, just thinking of this song every time gives me that little bit of ringing in the ears, electric brain cell short circuit of being there that night in that state of mind on that substance. But you know, even when I'm stone cold sober, it's a brilliant song. It's brilliant for its minimalism. It's brilliant for its sound. It's brilliant for its message and its lyrics and for its melody. You know, like all Naked Ray Gun songs, it is insanely catchy. And I wonder sometimes when I see Naked Ray Gun now, today, and they're still almost as great as they were then, you know, and three quarters of the audience has no idea what he's singing about, what Managua was, where Managua is, and why it meant something when Throb Throb came out. But I remember.
Left probably soon after Throb Throb, or before the next record, is that true?
Yeah.
What were the circumstances?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I was getting burnt out. I'd been using all my vacation time to be in the band, and weekends. I think I had pretty much had it. Ian was pushing us to do a record for Christmas, and I felt that Throb Throb took a long time to do, and I felt that it was rash to rush it. And I'm not sure I had anything left. Thought leaving made a big difference for me, because, of course, we're no longer in the basement writing all these wonderful songs. Now it became more of a struggle for me, so I didn't have that conduit. So that's pretty much it. I think I was just... it was time for me.
Did the band tour as much as you would have wanted? And are the old rumors true that this may have led to one of the reasons of you leaving the band?
There was a point where I thought that I wanted to tour more than the rest of the guys did, or more specifically, Jeff and his wife did. You know, they both had full-time jobs, you know, good jobs and all that stuff, and it just wasn't a priority to them, you know, at that time, and I thought it should be. You know, I wanted to make a living off of music, and those two were already making a good living without music, so that was a pretty big problem. And also with the, more so than that, the reason for me leaving was I just didn't like the way it was going in terms of Karen's influence on the band, or Karen's participation in band, you know, matters. I had a big problems with that.
You know, there's usually one writer, maybe one other guy that, you know, that person bounces ideas off of. With that record, there's a lot of writers on it, so we were pretty fascinated with, you know, how that whole thing came about.
Yeah, it seemed like somebody would quit Naked Ray Gun about every year and 3 months. It's not like there's a great exodus and then a great influx of people. Like, slowly the band changed members. It didn't bother me, because I would say, well, we'll just get this guy then. I always kind of insisted that everybody try to write, including the drummers, which is a good case in the case of Eric Spicer and a bad case in the case of Jim Colale. Jim Colale had more rhythm than any white man I ever met. I always said that about him. But he was leaning towards way poppy music and dancey stuff, and if you could hear the songs we didn't use of his, you'd be amazed.
How did they, was it a democracy in sort of choosing, or did you sort of take the lead?
Somehow I became like the Nazi leader of Nick and Reagan, and slowly declared it a dictatorship. And everybody did what I said, basically, because things got done. Because, you know, you bring ideas to a band, like a manager would come to a band and say, you have to decide whether to play these three shows, and then she would leave, and then we would all, everybody would sit around and go, duh, 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 duh.
for about an hour, and I would say, okay, I'm designing that. Then it just became quicker just to tell people what to do, which probably pissed people off, like Haggerty, but at least we got a lot of stuff done.
What is the band Naked Ray Gun?
To me, the import of that band was that they were very early on in the punk scene in Chicago, they demonstrated that you could get away with murder, that you could do basically anything you wanted. If you want to play ridiculous cocktail music and, you know, dress like a playboy, no problem. If you want to bleach your hair white and, you know, have sort of outer space music, no problem. If you want to take a bunch of drugs and just fuck around on stage for a half an hour and not listen to what the audience has to say about it, no problem. They represented a kind of an ideal to me of doing whatever the fuck interested them at the moment without being at all concerned about what expectations other people might have for them and still ending up with stuff that was really entertaining and really invigorating and solid. You know, at the time, the punk scene in Chicago was so fragmented and so fractured. There were just individual pockets of activity in different corners of the city, and Naked Ray Gun was kind of like a beacon for everybody. Like, everybody went to those shows. Everybody saw them. Everybody liked them. All the sort of, like, the gay crowd really liked them because they were stylish and they were really fun-loving. The working-class, like, thuggish punk rock type guys liked them because they were powerful. They didn't mess around. They had a playful approach, but it never seemed like they were joking, you know? It never seemed like they weren't really into what they were doing. So their sort of confidence and commitment to what they were doing was evident, and that made an impression on people like that. And then the people who were, like, sort of outsiders, that were sort of pop music people who were kind of intrigued by the arty aspects of new wave and punk rock music, like, those people found elements of Naked Ray Gun that they could appreciate. It was so cool to me that so early in the process, there was a band that achieved on such a high level the kind of creativity and free-form expression and independence that, to me, ultimately kind of I really identified with. Like, that ultimately ended up being my rationale for getting involved in music at all, was that I could be all of those things. Oh, look, Naked Ray Gun is doing that. That's exactly the way I want to live my life.
Thank you for listening to the 8th episode of Jughead's Basement, featuring the classic Chicago band Naked Ray Gun with their first full-length record, Throb Throb. Next up, for episode 9, we will bring you the Mr. T Experience with their album, Love Is Dead. We will have interviews with Frank, Joel, and Jim from the band, and also their engineer and producer, Kevin Army, and their Lookout Records representative, Christopher Applegren. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement. Make sure to check out the other shows on the TNH Network right here at TuesdayNightHoot.com.